What's in the future for Clay County Schools? Just ahead, hear from their new superintendent. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen anytime. You can also stream this program live now on our Facebook page. And just ahead, Clay County School Superintendent Addison Davis steps into Studio 5 to take your questions. Get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, a national thought leader on the separation of church and state speaks in Jacksonville, plus the secrets of becoming a successful startup. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, Clay County School Superintendent Addison Davis has something in common with President Trump. He's looking back at his first 100 days in office right now. Davis, who was recently elected to the job by citizens hoping to heal divisions left by Clay's previous superintendent, has already started to make some changes in Clay County schools. And he's been mentioned as a possible replacement here in Duval County for departing Superintendent Nicolai Vitti, who's leaving for a job in Detroit. We begin the hour with a look at education as we welcome Clay County School Superintendent Addison Davis to the studio. Thanks for being here. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, and excited to be here and talk about Clay County Schools.
And what are your questions for Clay County Superintendent Addison Davis? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax or weigh in on our Facebook page where the show streams live as well as over the radio. Addison Davis, congratulations. First off, you stepped into, I think it's fair to say, a pretty dysfunctional situation when you replaced the outgoing superintendent. There was a lot of dissension and division, and the voters of Clay County elected you with hopes of setting the district on a better path. How would you look back on your first 100 days or so in office?
Yeah, it's it had the opportunity to enter a school system that was really, on the tipping point from moving from great to good. And now it's time for us to put systems and processes in place in order to get it back to a point where it's acknowledged as a top 10 school district in the state of Florida. I will tell you, the first 6 months of my time at Clay County Schools, it has really been extraordinary. We've found a school system that really provides a rich, rigorous, and relevant experience to our students. It has one of the best cultures that I've ever been in as it relates to the culture and the interaction between stakeholders, teachers, and students. Mm-hmm. And I will say this is a school system that truly values our people and really finds ways to proactively support them, value them, and connect them to the learning process. So, you know, the last 6 months has been really eye-opening in the sense that there's a need to build relationships, to create a sense of care, and also to put trust in the eyes of everyone in Clay County and to give them a sense of hope that we can continue to be acknowledged as one of the best school systems in the state of Florida.
549-2937 to connect with Clay County Superintendent Addison Davis. And so what about this business of restoring trust in the district? How difficult will that be? And without going into a lot of detail about the previous administration, there were some controversies that were difficult for Clay Countyans.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming in, I really work to listen and learn and gain access to our stakeholders, our caregivers, our business partners, our teachers, our support staff, to really listen and learn to figure out what's working, what's not, and what we can do differently. And I say it's all about creating a growth mindset in the sense that getting every stakeholder ready and prepared for change, but then coaching them along the way to identify what areas need to be changed in order to create the best working conditions for our employees, but the best educational and academic experience for our students. I say that in the last 5.5 months, allowing stakeholders, teachers to be at the table to make decisions on what we would do in the classroom has really gained us a lot of momentum moving forward. And I believe by surrounding us with the best leaders, the best educators, and finding proactive ways to retain and recruit high-level leaders and teachers, I will believe that we will continue to strive to become a top 10 school district.
Now, there's been speculation that you may not be long for Clay County. I need to ask you about that. Of course, you did work in the Duval County Public Schools before taking this job in Clay County. Duval School Superintendent Nicolae Vidi, as many know, is leaving Jacksonville, taking a bigger job in Detroit. You've been mentioned as being in the running to lead Duval County, a very different district from Clay County. Are you going to go for that job? And how do you see those two positions in terms of what it takes to build a successful school district?
Yeah, without a doubt. First and foremost, Duval County is truly an attractive job. It's the 20th largest school district in the nation. It's where I worked for 18 years, from a teacher to an assistant principal, vice principal, principal, to principal supervisor, and ultimately the chief of schools for the last three and a half years with Dr. Vidi. Learned a lot about how to elevate the experiences in Duval County. So as it relates to my name, I've said it often, flattered about the possibilities, but again, that job is truly attractive. But needless to say, right now, Nicolae Vidi is the superintendent in Duval County, and Addison Davis is the superintendent in Clay County, and really excited about the opportunities to lead Clay County from a good to great school district.
And we'll go to your calls for Addison Davis in a moment at 549-2937. It hasn't been boring. Right off the bat, you had all kinds of things. You were dealing with fires you were putting out. Recently, you had to deal with this flare-up when students made a racist Craigslist posting. There was a picture of two young black female students sitting at their desks in school, and it said another student had posted slaves for sale. You suspended that student and referred them to an alternative school. This is just one example out of so many that where a superintendent has to deal with issues around students that go beyond just learning their math and reading.
Yeah, this is an unfortunate situation that students were involved when one student made a really poor decision. As superintendent, you deal with so many different situations and incidents at schools, but this one as a leader really hit home for me. I'm really disheartened that this situation occurred in our school district. I will say that we have worked rigorously to identify that student and then dive deeper in order to have a better understanding of the culture at every one of our schools so that we celebrate a climate and a culture that really acknowledges and celebrates diversity. So a lot of things that we are putting in place to make certain that we are working with focus groups at Fleming Island High School of every subset of our students to really figure out how we can better support and how we can leverage a multicultural club to really acknowledge the great things that we're doing and really lead to work where we are truly united and everyone understands the Fleming Island way and also the Clay School District way.
And how would you look at the two districts? I mean, you came up through the Duval schools. Now you're in Clay County, very different counties in terms of the socioeconomic factors that drive educational success. Duval, it's one of the largest urban districts in the country. Clay County's more of a bedroom community. It's a less diverse community. There are different approaches in certain respects, I would guess, in terms of how you look at the benchmarks for driving student achievement.
Yeah, very different school systems. However, as a school leader, my job is to make certain that I am an instructional leader, a talent manager, an operational expert, and a climate and culture builder. No matter what school district you're in, a leader has to have those four facets and dimensions in order to be successful. Ultimately, we know that Duval County has 125,000 students and Clay County has 37,000 mm-hmm. students. They all are very unique in their own way and have their own individualized situations or areas of opportunity, I would say. But I can tell you that, the biggest difference is the socially economic makeup in the sense that Duval County has a true urban core and has 111 schools that are Title I, whereas in Clay County, we have 9. But I will say both counties are prime for greatness. They have a great opportunity to make national trends and marks in reference to improving student achievement and providing the best and most robust experiences for our kids.
I can't believe no one's calling. This normally education jams the phone lines. He's the current Clay County School Superintendent. He might be up for the job of Duval Superintendent. What are your questions for Addison Davis? It's 549-2937. Give us a call, everybody. And in a moment, we'll talk about the Clay County Fairgrounds School Showcase. That's coming up Saturday in Green Cove Springs. But first, let me ask you, have you been following? The other day, we had a member of the Duval County School Board, Becky Couch, here in studio, talking about some legislation moving in Tallahassee that deals with school funding, charter schools versus private schools. One bill is called Schools of Hope. Have you been following that, and how do you see that affecting Clay County schools?
Yeah, I've been following all of the legislative updates, and then this particular legislative update really would not impact Clay County. This is for schools that have continued to demonstrate the inability to perform in relation to the state accountability system for schools that have been repetitive D's and F schools. And fortunately, Clay County is a school system that is really fluid in the sense of having some really great schools academically, with a number of A and B schools and just a handful of C schools that we're working on to elevate. But in the sense in Duval County, it really is an unfortunate situation. We should not be releasing schools in any way, shape, or form to any entity. It should really stay to the local control. And I know that Dr. V and the school board in Duval is really focused on really maintaining and protecting these schools so they can continue to provide the best experiences for our kids. So hopefully that this will not gain momentum, and it'll be in a place where the school district continues to have local control of these schools and continue the work that the body of work that they are implementing in their school district.
Let's go to your calls now for Addison Davis, Clay County's Superintendent of Schools. 549-2937. Brooks is in Orange Park. Hey, Brooks, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
All right, thanks. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
I'd like to ask the superintendent, as I fall in the demographic as a recent college graduate that is interested slightly in getting a job teaching in Clay County, but many of my other contemporaries have seek to go out of Clay County, such as out of state. And I was wondering what the county is doing to retain some of our Florida graduates to get into Clay County and help improve it for everyone. Thanks.
Yeah, so we are excited about your interest in Clay County, and please reach out to email me about with your resume. But one thing we have to do is continue to retain and recruit first-round draft picks in our classrooms. We really want individuals who have the will set and skill set to work with our youth, and who understand pedagogy and understand are willing to learn how to leverage curriculum, especially in the areas of hard-to-fill positions such as mathematics and science. But we are working to identify incentives for our teachers internally to figure out to place them at schools of high needs in order to keep them, train them, and give them the necessary tools to be successful with our kids. So, we have right now around 200 positions that we hire a year in Clay County. So there's a number of positions that we currently just posted on our website. We encourage you to go to the website, apply, and shoot me an email, and I'd love to talk further with you about the possibilities in our school district.
What's your email?
It's addison.davis@myoneclay.net.
There you go. Okay. Calls from all over now, flowing into the studio. Mark is in Mayport. Hey, Mark. Good morning. I know you just gave it out over the air. I hope you don't get bombarded.
It's okay. I respond to every one of my constituents every day.
Oh, that's good to hear. Okay. Mark in Mayport. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. I was just curious. I just looked at the 2017 top high schools in the country list, and 6 out of 10 of them are now what looks like for-profit charter schools. Are we heading in that direction?
Where'd you see that, Mark?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember where it was. It was, I mean, you can Google it. This report's out there.
Okay.
My kids went to the magnet schools here in town, Douglas Anderson, and they got a great education. I'm a product of Falls Church, Virginia schools, which is always up there at the top. But I'm just wondering if we're giving away too much with these charter schools.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. And certainly, become a contender for Nicolai Vitti's job, that question is going to come up. It's such a hot button issue in Duval County, especially.
Yeah, from my side, I'm a product of public education. Mm-hmm. And I lead a public education system and worked in public education for the last 18 going on 19 years. So I'm going to remain public education strong. Now, I'm all about school choice for parents, and I have two children that go to public education schools, and I want the best opportunity for themselves. but we have to do a better job in public education providing the right pathways for our students so that they can really not only compete locally but compete nationally. And these profit charter schools see an opportunity to attract newcomers, and we've got to do a better job in our school districts marketing and really connecting with our stakeholders to show them that we have a great opportunity for our community.
Shelley in Middleburg. Hey, Shelley. Good morning.
Hi. Well, I was going to have a charter school question as well.
Because okay.
I've seen a lot more in Clay County, but I do have another question, and that's the previous administration had a very poor relationship with teachers, and one of the main pushes to get you into office was to have a better relationship, working relationship with the teachers of Clay County, who I think are the best ever. And I was wondering, you know, what are you going to continue to do to foster that really working relationship between the talented teachers that we have so they feel supported and want to stay in our county to teach?
Thanks, yeah. Shelley.
Yeah, so great question. You know, I can tell you, I spend the bulk of my mornings in schools. That way I have the opportunity to really go into classrooms and problem solve with teachers to identify how we can continue to create collectively the best experience for our kids. And that's to make certain that we have the right curriculums, they have the right supports. But not only do I go into a classroom to look at the experiences, but I sit and have conversations with teachers, whether they're in the hallways or in the classrooms or in the lounge is to order to identify how can I better support them to be successful. I also, once a month, I host a dialogue with Davis, and I invite a random set of teachers to come in to really talk about the experiences in our school district, and I continue to do that to stay relevant, to identify trends and patterns so I can continue to support them. But I can assure you, you are correct. We have the best teachers in the state of Florida and Clay County, and they will always be at the table as we make decisions related to curriculum and best practices in our school district.
Mary in Keystone Heights. Lots of Clay Countyans listening out there this morning. Hey, Mary, good morning.
Good morning. I moved up here from, I'm in Clay County now, but I moved up here from Lee County. And I was aware of the fact that the fire department was really on teachers and administrators to make sure they didn't have paper in inappropriate places and extension cords running around, helter-skelter. And I don't want to name call what school it is, but there's a school that I've been in a few times, a couple actually, where they have a lot of portables and they look like huge fire risks. And I'm wondering, when you go to these schools, are you escorted to specific classrooms? Because I think maybe you might want to make a few unannounced calls, because I see a disaster, at least I see property, maybe not children being hurt, but property being damaged just from,
okay,
you know,
all right. Should you do, I hear you, Mary. Okay, so thanks for the call, Mary. Should you do some drop-ins? Unexpected,
yeah.
Drop-ins freak all the teachers
so
out.
To be openly and honestly, every one of my school visits are unannounced.
Okay.
And I always go to, when I walk the classrooms, I always want to see intermediate and primary classrooms. I want to see a continuum of classrooms. And I usually go door-to-door. That way I'm not escorted to the best and the brightest, but I get a chance to see the continuum of services at a school so I can better understand how to support schools. We will work collectively with our operations and our school leaders to make sure we have the greatest and safest environment for both our teachers, yeah, support staff, and for our students. But I can tell you, we do have a number of portables in our school district. We're in the process of following in line with state statute that was created in 2003 to repurpose portables that are 20 years or older. So we're working with our maintenance department, operations department, to repurpose those portables to make sure they are in the best conditions and providing the best experience for our kids.
How big an issue is maintenance in Clay County? In Duval County, we've got a lot of really old school buildings. I would think Clay County's buildings are newer, but
right,
still maintenance is an issue.
Yeah, maintenance is an issue. It's all because of the amount of funding that we generate and the revenue that we have from the state of Florida. So we know that, you know, of the maintenance side, there's so many opportunities for us to have the 21st century cutting edge, you know, classrooms through technology, through having the infrastructure, through having, you know, vocational experiences or the necessary tools. tools and equipments for our academies. The issue is how do we divvy up our funding in order to make certain that all of our schools remain attractive, but also have the necessary equipment to provide them with the pathways for them to be industry certified in order to have those pathways to be successful as they seek to become full option graduates, which is to be college, career, life, or military ready.
Okay, and a call from Duval County. By the way, someone did email me the list of the best high schools in America. A caller mentioned that a minute ago. It's from U.S. News and World Report. I'll take a look at that later. Thanks for that email. Carlos is in Duval. Hey, Carlos, how are you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, seeing that you're probably a front runner for the Duval County job, I'd like to know your opinion on school uniforms going district-wide, especially at the elementary level.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Good question.
Yeah, so it is a good question. I will say this. I was one of the ones that led the work with some of the uniforms in Duval County, and we see that it really creates a sense of pride within the organization, and we see that kids don't really have to compete about what they wear, who they interact with, and it really takes the focus off the learner and more focus on the actual learning and the content. But I will say that we started to push an initiative to have a K-8 uniform policy in Duval, and it kind of got separated because as I was doing, me and my team and Dr. Vitti was doing our research, we couldn't really find any data that supports that uniform truly has a positive impact on student achievement. We see that it truly has a positive impact on climate and culture, which I believe is a great step in the right direction. But if we tried to push it and mandate it within a school district, we couldn't anchor it around how it truly impacts, accelerates student achievement, and also improving student learning. But I think kids look great in it, and it gives them a sense of ownership and pride.
Melissa in Orange Park. Good morning. Thanks for holding.
Hi, my name is Melissa, and I'm actually a product of the Clay County school system.
Uh-huh.
And I really appreciate the things that Superintendent Davis is talking about. And I will commend to him the activities of Suzanne Hall, who is the social worker at the Orange Park High School that I used to attend. And also just remind him of the students that are facing challenges in terms of not having homes in Clay County, and also some of the students who are couch surfing in Clay County, and just to recognize that they are facing challenges that not every student in our county faces.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, definitely aware that we have a number of students that potentially may be homeless or that are going through undesired experiences within our county. So we have hired a assistant superintendent of climate and culture, Mike McCauley, who is working with so many different partners and business partners through Clay Behavior, through Wolfson Hospital, through Baptist, through St. Vincent's, through Orange Park Medical, through additional wraparound services so that we can work to seek to develop the whole child and also work greater to develop the whole family. So there's a number of resources and wraparound services that we will continue to provide. Social workers are true student advocates who really go and help and assist break down barriers, whether it be through attendance, behavior, academically, so that we can really have indicators to help our students be most successful within our school district. This is something that we're greatly aware of, and we're working to problem solve, and we'll have new initiatives for 17-18 to really grasp that pocket of our learners in order to bring them back into our school district and give them a sense of hope.
And this Saturday, it's your first ever Clay County School Showcase coming up at the Clay County Fairgrounds in Green Cove Springs. What's on the agenda?
Yeah, what an exciting day for Clay County Schools. This is the first time ever that we've journeyed into marketing our school district. Uh-huh. And now with House Bill 7029, with a controlled open enrollment, we have to really try to compete. And with school choice being out there, not only are we going to be able to connect with stakeholders and community members and show and demonstrate and illustrate the great things we're doing in our county, but this is for students who are in our county, students who are attending charter schools, public schools, and surrounding county, to tell them we do have opens of seats available, and for them to come to interact and see the innovative programs that we have, to look at the quality services that we provide for academically, to look at what we can offer from a variety of programmatic and thematic opportunities, so that we can really show that we have an exciting world-class educational offerings for our community. And we'll have every one of our schools to be representative, so our parents and communities can interact with our leaders, our teachers, our staff, to really talk about the great things that each of our schools offer in a unique manner, and really create excitement within our school district and also within our surrounding counties.
And that's Saturday at the fairgrounds in Green Cove Springs. Meanwhile, it's a pleasure to have you, Addison Davis, superintendent of the Clay County Schools. Thanks so much for being here today.
No, thank you for having me, and excited about our movement in Clay County.
And much more still ahead later on the show, the 5 secrets of successful startups. We'll talk to the head of PS27 Ventures on that. But up next, the separation of church and state, a special discussion in Jacksonville tonight. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, the media and mental illness. The Netflix series 13 Reasons Why is under fire for one reason. It graphically depicts a teenager's suicide. Research suggests that could encourage copycats. But how much power do the media really have to risk lives or to save them? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Radio Lab.
Take your marks!
Why do Kenyans always win all those races?
The Kenyans have done it again. 1, 2, and 3.
And what happens to New York City's poop after it's pooped?
About 1.3 billion gallons every single day.
And why aren't kids afraid of quicksand anymore?
Well, what are you afraid of?
The alien in Pacific Rim. That would be totally more scary.
We'll have some answers on the next Radio Lab.
Saturdays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part 2.
Welcome back. Well, in the United States, churches have had tax-exempt status for about a century, ever since the start of the federal income tax, and of course it's due to their charitable focus. But beginning in the 70s, some religious leaders began to make moves to become political players, a trend that's led to controversy and division over the faith community's proper role in our public square. As just one recent example, President Trump has talked about repealing the Johnson Amendment. Ever since the 1950s, it's been illegal in this country for tax-exempt nonprofit groups to endorse or oppose political candidates. Repeal of that amendment might mean religious leaders could make their political contributions tax deductible and publicly endorse from the pulpit. The Supreme Court is hearing a case right now which could have far-reaching ramifications on the separation of church and state. We'll talk about that in a moment. And on Thursday, President Trump is expected to sign a controversial and long-awaited executive order on religious liberty, one much desired by Vice President Mike Pence. Against all of this backdrop, Rob Boston, the director of communications at Americans United for Separation of Church and State, is here in our area, and he joins us now with a preview of his talk in Jacksonville tonight, a look at the meaning of the religious freedom provisions of the First Amendment. Rob Boston, Good to see you. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me on.
There's so much to talk about. And what are your questions for Rob Boston? He's with Americans United for Separation of Church and State. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Everything from a Supreme Court case. It's Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia, Inc. versus Comer. It's a case in Missouri. I want to ask you about that. But first, let me get your thoughts about what's happening at the White House tomorrow, as President Trump is expected to sign an executive order on religious liberty. Thursday is also the National Day of Prayer. Advocates for religious liberty love this measure. Organizations such as yours see this as troublesome. Where do you stand on this?
Yes, we've been hearing rumors about this executive order for months now. It's problematic, to say the least. Essentially, what it's going to do is probably codify some type of discrimination in the name of religion. So federal agencies, federal contractors, and possibly others would have the right to, say, refuse service to members of the LGBT community on the grounds of religion. And it really, I don't think it's really a religious freedom provision so much as it is a codifying discrimination provision.
And an executive order, does it have the same weight as legislation?
Well, that's really the interesting question. I suspect that once this order is issued, a lot of groups are going to be looking at it under a microscope. I know Americans United will be. If there's an opportunity to get into court and challenge its provisions, you can bet we're going to be there. The president doesn't have the power to overturn federal laws with executive orders. And if we believe that there's something like that going on, or it's an overreach, yeah, we're going to be in court.
Okay. There's another case I want to ask you about that the Supreme Court decided to take, and they could issue a ruling in June. It has to do with Trinity Lutheran Church. They applied for a grant. They wanted to redo their playground, with like scrap from tires, and they were rejected by the Missouri Department of Natural Resources because they're a faith-based preschool daycare center. This is going to go to the Supreme Court, depending on how the court rules, and this will be Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch's first big case on this. He's consistently come down on the more conservative side of this type of topic. How does your organization see this case? How important is it?
Well, again, this is a concern, and it's a very important case because it has the potential to really redraw the lines between church and state in this country. Traditionally, in America, religious organizations have paid their own way. If they want to improve their facilities, put on a new roof, get a paint job, fix up their playground, they ask their members, their supporters, to pay for that, not the taxpayer. Now, a large number of states have provisions in their constitutions that say there can be no diversion of public money to religion. If a broadly worded Supreme Court ruling here could water those down, perhaps even obliterate them, which would be, in my view, a very serious mistake.
Meanwhile, the governor of Missouri the other day has defended this preschool, saying that to deny this school taxpayer funding in the interest of the safety of the students on the playground is religious discrimination. So one man's free speech is another man's religious discrimination.
I think it's really interesting how far we've fallen from separation in some regards in this country. I mean, the argument is seriously being made that if you fail to give public support to a religious institution, you are discriminating against it. That stands the First Amendment on its head. The very idea of separation of church and state is that we all have the freedom to choose what religion, if any, we want to be involved with, and then we pay for it with our voluntary contributions. We don't ask the taxpayer to pick up the tab.
There's another measure moving through Tallahassee. It has passed the House Education Committee. It's a bill that would allow school administrators to pray in public schools throughout the state if students initiate those prayers. Likely to be challenged?
Oh, absolutely. I would think that's kind of a full employment bill for church state attorneys.
What about, though, those that disagree with you and they have sincerely held religious beliefs? They think when we took prayer out of public schools, that's when we started having trouble with education in this country. What would you say to those?
Well, there's a lot to say about that. I think it's a very simplistic argument. I think that, first of all, we haven't really removed prayer from public schools. We have removed compulsory, required, or forced prayer from public schools. And the kids were being required to do this, whether it was part of their religious belief system or not. And we really don't want to go there. I think we need to keep in mind that we have a system whereby students have the right to pray voluntarily if they want to, but that they can't be compelled to take part in it. And I think that's the best answer for this issue.
All right. Let's go to your calls now for Rob Boston. He'll be giving a talk tonight in Jacksonville about his book, Taking Liberties. It has to do with religious freedom and the separation of church and state. What are your thoughts and questions? It's 549-2937. Mark is in Orange Park right now. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just had a question about, for example, in education. Many people are upset about the possibility of utilizing vouchers from the public funds and parents sending their kids to Christian schools, religious schools, saying, oh, there's a separation church and state. We can't do that. What makes that any different than, for example, using Medicare or Medicaid dollars in a religious healthcare institution locally here like Baptist Hospital or St. Vincent's Hospital, where ultimately taxpayer dollars are going to care that is given in a religious institution?
Thanks, Mark.
Right. The situation there really looks at what type of an institution you're dealing with. Does it exist primarily to impart religious instruction, or is it providing a largely secular service? A lot of religious hospitals do receive public funding, but they're serving everybody. They don't discriminate in hiring staff, and they're basically providing health care, which is a secular service. Schools are different. Religious schools oftentimes do discriminate in hiring staff. They don't allow certain students to be involved if they're not the members of the sponsoring faith. They may teach religious doctrine in all of their subjects. And therefore, it is seen as problematic to direct tax support to those types of institutions.
Let me ask you, though, because sometimes these cases can be murky. The case that's gone to the Supreme Court, Trinity Lutheran from Missouri, they are a Christian school. They evangelize. They preach Christianity. But they're going to argue that most of the kids at the preschool don't go to the church and aren't getting that instruction, and that they shouldn't be denied taxpayer funds to resurface the playground based on that argument. So how do you come down on these issues when it's not as clear cut sometimes as other cases have been?
Right. Well, I think you really need to look at a couple of things. One is, what is the sponsoring organization? If it's a church, they're obviously going to be spreading a religious message, whether they're giving it to their own members or potential members really is irrelevant. And secondly, it's just a matter of, like I said earlier, about the physical plant, the actual building, the grounds. Traditionally in this country, those types of things have been paid for by members of the congregation. You know, you could argue that if a church's roof starts to sag, that it might collapse and people could be hurt. Does that mean we can have a federal or a state program to build new roofs for houses of worship or give them new furnaces if they start to experience problems? That's not the way we've done it in this country. You pay your own way when it comes to religion. You don't ask your neighbor to pay for it.
Bill in Mandarin. Hello, Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, it seems that whenever we do this kind of legislation to return, quote, power to the local communities, we actually seek to enshrine things that are more damaging than helpful. By this, I mean, for example, there is no doubt that pure religion attempts at diversity. Just wondering about your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Well, you know, I think we need to keep in mind that in this country, we really are lucky in that we have this wide range of religions and non-religious philosophies to choose from, and people can be involved in them or not as they see fit, but you pay your own way. I'm going to go back to that because that's really the core argument. That's been what we've been doing in this country for more than 200 years, and whenever the government gets involved and decides to try to help religion or to, you know, push things along or advocate for it, it usually has a very negative impact on religion. So I would argue that really it's religious institutions and religious individuals who need to be most concerned about these breaches of separation of church and state.
What if the court comes down in favor of the religious organization in Trinity Lutheran v. Comer? What does that mean for this issue in this country?
We could end up with a situation where religious organizations are turning more and more to the state, to the government, to the taxpayer for support, And I don't think we need to look much beyond, say, many Western European nations to see what that's done to religion. Yeah, they have state support. Sometimes they even have an official church like in England. And of course, they have about 3 or 4% of people actually showing up.
Adam tweets the show taken too far. Anyone or any group could claim faith-based and not pay taxes and discriminate. We should tax churches.
Well,
isn't that a political non-starter in this country?
That is. It's a very controversial view, and a lot of people think we should do that. But I would argue that, you know, because tax exemption is extended to lots of other types of nonprofits, it's okay. And remember, if you're talking about taxing churches, you're all going to be talking about taxing a lot of secular nonprofits that hold tax-exempt status as well.
Lots of tweets. Ken on Twitter, Christians mostly agree on the difference of politics versus partisanship. Politics makes systemic changes, not politician endorsement. Brian, in the 1700s, Americans and Brits thought establishment of a religion involved tax support for it. Did we forget that? Okay, let's go to George in Deerwood now. Hi, George. Good morning.
Hey there. Good morning. Melissa, I enjoy your show so much.
Thanks.
And I want to welcome Rob to Jacksonville.
Thank you.
I'm so proud of my niece. She works for AU in Washington. Her first name is Rebecca.
Okay. Nice to have you calling in.
I want to tell Rob I'm a strong supporter of AU. I give monthly to their cause. And I'm always speaking up in favor of what AU is trying to accomplish. And it really bothers me, these people that tried to erode separation of church and state. My thought is religion should be in a family. And they should, families should promote religion. And this argument that... all this trouble began when they took prayer out of schools is just erroneous.
Thank you, George. Thanks for that. One more call. Terry in San Marco. Go ahead, Terry.
Yes, I just wanted to discuss quickly the impetus of this. 83% of the country is religious. I come from a town where the Catholic Church was on a tax-exempt status for so long that it ended up owning half the real estate in the town and bankrupted the town because it literally couldn't float itself on its own taxes. So I see his point. But to the greater, why are we here now in 2017 is my own theory, and that is Keynesian economics. Aggregate demand depends on family size. It depends actually on what they call household consumption. If you look at the equations...
Need a quick comment, Terry. We're a little tight on time.
Okay. Well, it just... The push to religion is to push back into family, to create that, reorder that, and create larger family sizes. And
okay.
Put women in a position where they're having one, not one, but 3 and 4 child per family, because it's an economic thing.
Okay. Thanks for that. And she's getting at some deeper ideas, which unfortunately we don't have the time to get into, but it's been a fascinating discussion. You'll be speaking tonight about your book, Taking Liberties, Why Religious Freedom Doesn't Give You the Right to Tell Other People What to Do, a book club discussion with the First Coast Freethought Society, 6:30 p.m. at the Mandarin Library on Corey Road. Rob Boston with Americans United. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, the history of government-mandated housing segregation in 20th century America in the North. We'll talk to Richard Rothstein, author of the new book, The Color of Law. The government policies he writes about explain how housing projects became predominantly black and how suburbs became predominantly white. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
So one day I approached her after class, and I was like, Mrs. Brown, I am in love with Abby, and you have got to put me next to her. So Mrs. Brown says, I'll see what I can do.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour. True stories told live. No notes, no net. From the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, Dee Dee Bridgewater, newly crowned NEA Jazz Master.
You know, it's just like all of a sudden people are saying I'm a jazz legend. I don't know what this means. I'm out here just trying to work.
With music from Songs of Freedom, a program curated by Ulysses Owens Jr.
Drive a man who made a life.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Keep on moving.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, picture this. In one office, frozen dessert is being sold around the world. Down the hall, a stress relief program is trying to get off the ground. In yet another office, digital menu boards are being created for restaurants coast to coast. Now, this is just a sampling of what you'll see if you visit PS27 Ventures on Jacksonville's South Side. It's a place where young companies are being born or growing. With more about this fascinating incubation center, we welcome Jim Stallings, founder and managing partner of PS27 Ventures. He's here now with more about the five secrets of successful startups. Jim, good to see you.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Now, you had a great career at IBM. When you retired from that job, you got involved in OneSpark. Of course, that's a festival that is all about growing startups in this area. And how was PS27 born from that experience?
Yeah, sort of. You know, honestly, what happened when I first retired was a little company came to me and said, hey, we got a great idea. We, you know, gave them some money. And you know, a couple of weeks I went away, came back, and I asked him, how's it going? You know, what are you doing? What did you do in the past couple of weeks? And it took me about a minute to figure out if I didn't help this company out, I'd never get my money back.
So yeah, that'd be throwing money down the drain.
Yeah, that's exactly. So we started creating a model back then on how do we help the company with their strategy? How do we help mm-hmm. them figure out their customers? How do we help them find customers? Mm-hmm. They needed a bank loan. We helped them get a bank loan. I mean, it was all of the basics you would imagine in a startup. And over time, we learned most startups have sort of a few gaps. And mm-hmm. it's around picking the right people, having a really, really big idea, having a good financial model. Some of those basics. And that became PS27's program. And we run it every year, every week, every day. We're working with the company. So that's how it began.
And it's grown. You started small, and now you've invested in and you are supporting a whole array of fascinating companies like Naturally Smart. They make this great high-protein frozen dessert. There's a company called WooshFly. It's like an Uber for private jets. I don't need that service, but I know some people do. Lots of companies that you're investing in and you're backing. And so this startup model seems to be one that's working because, as you said, startups, when they get going, it can be rocky. They need a guy like you to kind of put the guardrails and the investment in place mm-hmm. so that they can go from the runway to flying.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what companies need in the early days is someone to talk to, a place to go to help them really think through, is this a big idea? Is it a good idea? They also need someone to give them some feedback on, are they the right person? Is it the right time? A lot of big startups, it's about timing, it's about luck, it's about being in the right place at the right time. But it's also about passion. It's about a commitment to the idea. You know, you get knocked around as an entrepreneur. People are going to push back on the idea. You're going to challenge the status quo. So you need someone to push you forward, someone to help you understand what's really, really required. The other thing we help companies do is we connect them to other smart people, mm-hmm. people in the industry, people that have better connections, deeper connections. We also connect them to money. But the important thing is they need a place to go, a mentor, an advisor, to really talk to almost on a daily basis. And that's the real strength of PS27.
What are the five secrets you want to share for people
there are a lot of secrets, but one of them is to be a really good entrepreneur, you got to be a good person. I mean, you got to have a high sense of integrity. You got to be passionate. You got to be committed. You got to believe when nobody else believes. You got to understand when nobody else. You got to have a vision for how this thing could play out big time across the world. So it always comes back to the character, of the founder. That's the most important criteria. The other thing is important. You've got to have a good idea. You know, our saying around our team is, you know, we'd rather have a good person with an average idea versus, you know, an average person with a really, really good idea. So you've got to have a big idea, something that's going to be transformative and change the world. The other thing is you've got to take the time to understand the financials around your business. We run into a lot of folks that just can't grasp the financials.
And you help them with that. That's a big piece.
You have to go get some help in many cases.
Now, for every 100 companies that come to you, Jim Stallings, you only pick a few. It's a high bar to get in with you.
Yeah, it's a high bar. We have a selection process. They meet with us on every Tuesday. We have a, what we call deal review days. It's a lot like Shark Tank. They come in, they do the pitch. We, you know, harass them.
You should
have
your own TV show.
Yeah, we should. It was at least a radio show. But if they get through the first 45 minutes or so, we go into another stage called a workout. It's a four-hour meeting. It's a deep dive into what are the big opportunities and challenges around a business. And then at some point, we invest in joint. So out of 100, we pick only three companies to invest in. So we see a lot. But it's a very selective process. We have a grading system. The founders, when they come in, they don't know about it, but we have a 100-point grading system. If they make 70 points, they get to go to the next stage.
They got to get a C at least.
Got to get at least a C.
Okay. And by the way, last question, what does PS-27 stand for?
We named this after Psalm 27. Many years ago when I was in the Marine Corps, you know, we used to recite Psalm 27 before things happened. And we decided once we start our company, it was going to be called Psalm 27. If you go read it, it really says you shouldn't fear anything because you've got a lot of help.
That's fantastic. And if you have a good idea that you think deserves funding and support, contact Jim Stallings, founder and managing partner at PS27, right there on Bayberry Road. They're expanding. And congrats on your success. It's fascinating to speak with you.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And never miss a show. Just download the WJCT app. Listen there or on iTunes. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.